The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
On News Talk.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of the Home Show podcast. I'm Sinead Ryan, your host. Coming up today, what's in a name? Why do people name their houses? And what does it say about them and their property? We look at a campaign to clean up our beaches by telling us what not to flush down the toilet. A seasonal approach to interiors in a gorgeous new book. And Natasha Rockadivine will be decorating for your little one's bedroom. If you'd like to get involved in our podcast, then you can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me over in social channels at Instagram and X at SineadRyan100. And of course, you can listen back to all the bits you'd missed or any of the shows that you'd like to hear again on our podcast, which is newstalk.com or on the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. Now, there's been lots of politics over the last week, and I promise we are not going to talk about it today. We saw a swing from right to left for the French. We saw a new British Prime Minister across the water. Keir Starmer's election seems to have made people very happy, or happier at any rate, including our own government. He's worked in Northern Ireland for some time, after all. He knows the issues well, so that kind of bodes well maybe for us. And he proudly went through the doors of number 10 Downing Street with his wife during the week, and I'm sure we all wish him well, not least trying to renegotiate the bits of Brexit they got wrong. Now, we have, of course, an official residence for our own Taoiseach too. It's Farmley House in the Phoenix Park, but they've never lived there. Leo Varadkar didn't want to live there, and Simon Harris, who's in Greystones, doesn't want to live there. Do you think they should, though? Would it be seen as elitist, or would it be a great way to protect, you know, what is the family of our Prime Minister, our Taoiseach? Let me know what you think, because, you know, it's perfectly positioned. Maybe politicians don't like to be out of their constituency too much. Or maybe we think, oh, what are they like? Do they have notions? Anyway, Farmley House for our Prime Minister, for our Taoiseach, or not? Let me know. I'd be very interested in your views on that. And you're very welcome along to the Home Show. Now, most of our addresses begin with a number, but on any given street or road, you'll find the odd house or two with a name. Is it a good idea to name your house? Why and how do people choose what to call it? Well, Anna McHugh is head of corporate communications at On Post, which has to be the organisation that sees this more than practically anybody else. Anna, you're very welcome to studio.
Thank you, Sinead.
Now, it must be, the first thing that struck me when it came to the names, because we're going to look later at the most popular names and the most common names in Ireland, right? And folks, if you can think of the most common names, do let us know. Whatever you think it might be, we'll have a competition. There's no prize for it, but it'll be a bit of fun to find out. It strikes me that it must be more difficult for postmen and women to find a house that has a name rather than a number, or at least I presume it was before the old air code.
Okay, well, firstly, air codes are wonderful. But they're wonderful. We use them in the sorting of mail, and all kinds of delivery companies and utilities, emergency services use them and are delighted to have them to find locations. But when it comes to actual mail, you still need your full postal address. And we find houses with names in all kinds of places. But where we really love to see them is in areas around the country, usually more rural areas, where the address is what we call in our jargon non-unique. So that's where you're in an area where you have your name and your address is simply a townland and the county.
And is it also the case that they are the very places where you have the same generations of family, maybe called the same names or similar?
Very often you will have multiples of houses with the same names and indeed the same Christian names of many different generations, as you say.
Jimmy Murphy, James
now,
Murphy,
you're a local
James John Murphy.
Or a postman knows everybody. And they'd nearly know by the type of parcel or the type of letter who it's for, because they have that wonderful local knowledge. But where we'd say, if you do have a non-unique address, a house name makes great sense, because it will make life easier for all those companies and utilities that might need to find you.
Okay.
And most of all, emergency services.
So if you don't have a number, so for the people, there's two type of people then. There's the people who have a number, you know, one main road, and they decide to call their house a name on top of that. Mm-hmm. But then you've those other people who've no number or street.
Exactly. So now, in a lot of other countries, we'll say France, for example, no matter where you live, right across, we'll say France, every single road, little road, side road, boreen, has a name. So we're quite different in Ireland
in our
geography and our topography, right? Where you have so many, as we call them, non-unique addresses, just a town and a county. So that's where a name, as well as the fact that it can be really lovely for a house in a lovely location to have its own name. Makes it attractive, can work really well, can mean an awful lot to a family or within a locality, a nice Irish name or something that is very meaningful to a particular family.
Because I know there are probably some families who name it after some special memory or some devotion or something like that. Give us an idea of the most common names that you come across in on post.
Well, interestingly, from the research we've done for you, the most common ones aren't really the most imaginative.
Well, go on, give us an idea.
And they might be a little disappointing.
Oh, right. Okay.
Really, when it comes to it. The most common name that we see in the research we've done is actually the bungalow.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear.
How deflating.
And it's right up there with that is the cottage.
Oh, I see. Oh, right. That's just it. The cottage and then the townland. So that's not going to help you a whole deal.
And the highest proportion of houses with those names are found in Cork, in both those cases.
So lots of bungalows and cottages in Cork.
Exactly.
Everybody wants to call their house the bungalow or the cottage.
Exactly. Another one that's very popular overall is parochial house.
Well, there are a lot of parochial houses. Do you think there's some called the parochial house that indeed aren't, like the rectory or the vicarage?
We would assume, indeed, or the old vicarage, like Vera Duckworth used to say in Coronation Street many, many years ago. Rose Cottage is another one. That's very popular and very quaint and very lovely. There's Hillview and Hillcrest. And Ashling is another one that's found on a regular enough basis.
Yeah, you would see that.
Now, we looked at this a number of years ago. And when we looked at it again this time, what had changed over the years was saints' names. Because the last time we did it, the saints were right up there at the top as the most popular.
And who are the most popular saints?
Well, you know, there he is, Saint Anthony. St. Anthony's, popular as well with a lot of kind of B&Bs and things like that.
That's
guest
true.
Houses. And St. Jude.
Oh, here.
The hopeless cases.
So the hopeless cases and the lost things.
They're
what
right
does
up
that
there.
Say about now, us as a people calling our houses after dismal events?
I spoke to some of our delivery staff because they're the oracles and they know they're the best people to tell you about these things. And they think, well, often you'll find that a business like that has a name to make it more because they need to put up a sign. They'll have some sort of display or sign on the house. And you know, that's where you'll find them most commonly. But they'd both, the people in different parts of the country that I spoke to this week said that they have noticed that as some of those houses with those names change hands, that either the name is dropped or the name is changed.
Interesting. So it's possible if you're living in a house, you bought a new house and it's called St. Jude and you think, I don't want to live in a house called St. Jude. I'm not a hopeless case. I'm grand. Thanks very much. But I went to Sorrento on my honeymoon and I want to call it that. It's possible to change the name?
It absolutely is.
How do you do it?
Now, this is if you're a house owner, right? I have to make that clear. You know, if you're a tenant there.
Don't go changing your landlord's names. Right, okay.
But whether you want to add a name to your house or you want to change a name, the same rules apply. You obviously should let your local post person know. I'd say first, actually, if you're going to do it, commit to it. You can't half do it and sort of do it. You need to do it for real and, you know, and use the new name and do it properly.
And tell all your correspondents.
Tell everybody.
Okay.
So firstly, you need to display that new name, not just on your hall door, but on your gatepost or your gate or wherever the access is to your property. And sometimes we see lovely, ornate, you know, creative homemade signs, but they're sort of indecipherable with squiggly writing or things that fall off in bad weather or seashells or whatever. If you're going to do it properly.
Get the sign made.
Yeah, it has to be very, very clear.
Okay.
Let your postperson know. So it's important that obviously your postman, your postwoman or your local delivery depot are fully aware. And you should also, very important, to let your local authority know.
Okay.
Because they're really the guardians of addresses for local authority reasons, the electoral register, all of those sort of things.
Okay.
So if that is how it will become properly registered, then you start using it and you use it all the time on your, if you're shopping online with your friends, your family, all your financial details, put it on your Christmas cards.
And every day you'll get used
get
to it.
Get it out there, yes.
So are there any laws or rules around house names? I mean, presumably, if you called your house something, I don't know, very offensive, like Hitler's Nest, somebody would have a view on that, wouldn't they?
Yeah, well, you know, that you'd probably get correspondence from your local authority eventually about that.
And somebody would
it's
complain.
Something I'd have to say we don't come across
okay.
too often.
Okay.
Now, you do find kind of highfalutin names, you know.
Oh, give us an idea
on
of the
modest, on modest properties, the likes of, you know, Sorrento View. Sanssouci is something we see sometimes. No worries. Sanssouci,
okay.
which is very salubrious.
Right,
altogether.
Yes. Okay. And Sorrento View, so that wouldn't really fit on a three-bed in Clondalkin or something.
It might not,
okay.
but
okay.
no, every,
but listen,
everyone to their own.
Indeed, indeed.
Yeah. Mountain View, I said Ashling is another, you know, is another popular one, meaning dream. And we know also that people sometimes like to continue on a family name or a favourite pet or indeed like a Christian name. They call their name, they call their house maybe Catherine.
Oh,
you know,
right.
Or
okay.
Isabel.
Maybe
or
they've just taken off the
be.
Saint on some of those.
Okay.
And you get a mashup sometimes then of us two surnames, you know, people moving into a house together, which always looks a bit strange.
What is important, though, you know, you're going to commit to it. The more complicated or complex it is, or, you know, if it's in another language, the more risk there is of error.
Oh, people spelling
people
it wrong.
Okay.
It wrong. Okay.
No more than there is with Christian names and surnames and everything else. So what we would say to people is simplicity is key.
Grand.
Keep it easy. Make sure that people can incorporate it, that it's not going to be a big long rigmarole that's going to push them over onto another line or something, particularly if you're now shopping online and the like. Often you don't have an awful lot of room and time to be doing all of that.
Is there any reason why people give their houses names when they have a perfectly good number? Do you think it's a kind of, there's a, it's something elite about it, or they feel kind of, I'll call it, you know, such and such lodge, you know, at the top of the road. Is there a bit of that about
it? There may well be, but it's not a problem as long as it doesn't replace a number. If your house has a number, you can't just automatically, you know, drop the number and start using a name.
Okay.
Add the name if you like, but beware that that is adding another line on your address. And some people's addresses have been quite long, you know.
Yeah.
But another piece is that use your correct postal address.
Yeah.
Don't add in lines so it becomes like a set of instructions to find your house.
Yeah, the one up at the top of the hill, turn right at the post office.
Exactly.
All right.
Because it's important that you stick to the correct address so that the routing gets to you, it comes to the correct delivery office and out to you as quickly as
now,
possible.
Now, of course, you've had first-hand experience of this, Anna, because on Post have had to move their address. You have moved from the absolutely fabulous, iconic estate, absolutely extraordinary building of the GPO. Tell us where you all are now.
Well, most of us in headquarters are now in the EXO building, which people will recognise. It's getting a lot of, it's seen a lot in the background on movies and dramas and things on RTE. It's right beside the Three Arena as you go over the East Link Bridge. It is the tall building with the blue X's on the side of it, which reflect the cranes in Dublin Port.
All right.
As we're looking down on the splendour of Dublin Port and the river. And there's almost 1,000 of us based there now.
So what is happening then with the GPO? Do we know what's going to come of it or what's going into it?
Well, pleased to say we still have about 180 staff based in the GPO. And of course, the wonderful post office hall there that will continue forever, and the wonderful GPO Museum.
Which is fantastic, by the way, and definitely worth a visit.
Yeah, it is.
It's amazing.
It really is, and great feedback from tourists. So that all continues. But in the future, the building now has been handed back by the Department of Communications to the Office of Public Works, and they're looking at different options for it now.
What would you like to see going in there? Not another hotel, please.
In the context of, well, look, it is the most important building in the state.
Isn't it?
Yes. It is very beautiful. You know, there isn't, it's, and it is the longest operational postal headquarters in the world.
Wow.
They're as a postal headquarters since 1818. So we're very proud of that.
There should be huge
office accommodation at the back. It needs a lot of work.
Yeah.
It really, really does.
And it is protected and it's listed and all of those things.
Yeah.
So
and
one would hope
very hopeful,
it would be too much effort for a hotel.
Well, you know, there's great opportunities there for the artistic community, for, you know, for promoting heritage there. Mm. And I know that there's the very best of minds looking at it.
Maybe there'll be a consultation.
It'll retain its important part, place in O'Connell Street.
All right. Well, listen, Anna McHugh, thank you for coming in to us from On Post to talk us through the house names and the house numbers. And let us know, folks, if you have a name in your house, why you named it, and if you'd ever think of changing it. We'd love to hear from you. Anna, thanks a million for joining
thank
us.
You.
Now, the Think Before You Flush campaign, operated by Clean Coasts in partnership with Uisce Éireann, emphasises the importance of appropriate flushing behaviour and disposal of items, including wipes and other products, even if they are labelled as flushable, which I think might come as a surprise to some people. Well, Patrick Cross is campaigns manager at Clean Coasts and joins me on the line now. Patrick, you're welcome to the Home Show.
Thanks for having me, Sinead.
Now, tell us a little bit about the Clean Coasts organisation. You've been around for, what, a couple of decades?
Yeah, been around for a few decades and work with groups all over the country. There's over 2,000 Clean Coast groups all over Ireland, all different types of organisations. We have one here that I'm involved in Lahinch, which is called Banner Glow. And we run multiple different programs as 2 Minutes Beach Clean, Love Your Coast as a photography award, and Think Before You Flush. That's just three of the things we do.
All right.
And at the moment, the one we're working on, at least the one that I'm working on, is Think Before You Flush in collaboration with the Blue Flag program.
Well, then give us an idea of the type of things that people flush down the loo that they shouldn't be flushing down the loo. Now, I'm sure the wipes are a big one because they are so common now. It just seems to me we're using them all the time in kitchens, in bathrooms, on children's bums, all the time. And there are some that say biodegradable or flushable. Are you suggesting they're not?
They're not, generally speaking. I actually went today, I'd better go and have another look just for my own peace of mind to see, are there really flushable wipes out there? And there really isn't. I think what they're trying to say is that they'll physically go down the toilet. But the problem is the components of a wet wipe to make it stay moist and stable and not disintegrate. Well, there's plastic in there and chemicals, but they just don't break down. So we do an experiment when we go to schools with kids where we'll get 2 jars of water, put tissue paper in one and wet wipes in the other, and they just simply shake them and you end up with a jar of pulped toilet paper in one hand and the other one is a solid wet wipe that hasn't broken down at all. So calling them flushable is, they shouldn't be called flushable. They should always go in the bin.
So tell us some of the other ones then that shouldn't be flushed or put anywhere near the toilet.
So cotton buds would be one, cleansing pads, cigarette butts, plasters, tampons. There's many of them. Even human hair is considered one of them. And I think a lot of us, human hair is going to go down the shower sometimes.
Yeah.
Nappies is one. I mean, I don't know.
Nappies?
How many people are
puts nappies down the loo?
I know, I was wondering that one myself. I'm not so sure. Apparently that happens. That seems like a big object to go down the toilet.
Well, people would be surprised now by the cotton wipes because, you know, you would think they're just cotton and you're taking off your makeup or you're using them on your face and you're just chucking them down the loo. You're saying no to that?
No, don't put them down the toilet. The issue is that, so they don't break down, so they end up clogging up the wastewater systems and they'll leak in, cause sewage overflows is one of the big issues and that can impact the environment.
Right.
And we have another campaign called Think Before You Pour, which is about what you pour down the sink in your kitchen. And it's good to talk about both of them together because they impact each other. think before you pour is about fogs, fats, oils and greases from cooking, basically.
Mm.
And it's trying to avoid too much pouring that down the sink. And the issue is because it cools and congeals, and that can cause a problem as is. But if you mix it in with these sanitary items, you get serious blockages.
And you get the old fatberg. Isn't this a big problem down on sewers and things where all this stuff congeals in at the side? And apologies to anybody who's having their morning coffee listening to us, but it congeals at the side and then it's very, very difficult to get rid of.
Yeah, and it happens a lot. It happens in Ireland a lot. So Ishgairn cleaned out a couple of thousand of them a year. And famously, there was a fatberg in London in 2017 that weighed 130 tons and it was the length of 2 football pitches.
So
we might not match those dimensions, but they're best avoided. And we have models of fatbergs that we bring around to schools and they are hideous looking things. Even the models look awful.
Say they are. Well, that doesn't leave a lot then, Patrick. So tell us the things that you can flush down the toilet.
It's only 3 of them. It's a very simple campaign message. Pee, poo and paper. They're the only things that should ever go down the toilet. Everything else, any other sanitary item into the bin, even if it says flushable on it, you're better off just sticking it in the bin.
Right. Well, there's a message for us all now. Very important. All right. And listen, how is the beaches, the blue flags? I mean, I read there are more blue flag beaches now this year. They all seem to be hopefully doing a little bit better. Are we happy enough with how our coastlines look or is there a lot more to be done?
Well, I've been out on the coast for the past couple of days there now. I was down in Spanish Point and the Willie Clancy Trad Festival on, so the place was absolutely heaving. That place was in great condition. It's a mixed bag. Some places are good, some places are different, but there's more every year, which is always a good sign. There's 94 this year, and that's a mixture of beaches, lakes and marinas. Mm. So we always want the number to be going up, but it is a case of if people can do their part when you're at the beach. It's the same thing as when you're at the beach as when you're at home, that just try to avoid flushing these things down the toilet. That's really what this action is about with the Blue Flag Programme, to support the local authorities in this message.
All right. Well, Patrick Cross, Campaign Manager at Clean Coasts, and you can find at Clean Coasts on Twitter and Instagram. And the campaign, you can find that at thinkbeforeyouflush.org. Patrick, thanks a million for joining us on The Home Show.
Thanks, Sinead. Take care. Thank you.
Now, most of us are probably familiar with the concept of cooking and eating seasonally, but how can that idea be translated to decorating and interiors? Well, without it costing us a fortune, Kay Presney and Becca Cherry are co-authors of a beautiful new book called A Home for All Seasons, and they join me on the line now from the UK. Kay and Becca, you are very, very welcome along to The Home Show. Let me start with you first, Kay. This book, essentially, which, as I said, is beautifully presented, seems to me more to be about people's stories, how they've incorporated seasons, colours and textures and design elements into their own homes, rather than a how-to full of tips for people.
Hello, thank you so much for having us today. It's a real pleasure to be on your show. Exactly that. I think what we are hoping for people to get from our book is a really soulful way of decorating with the seasons. So it's not about laying out trends. It's not about saying things that you should and shouldn't have, or saying what seasons you need to decorate for and changing everything with each season. It's much more about absorbing what makes you feel good throughout the year and aligning with seasonal living so that you have a sense of connection to nature. I think we've become quite distanced from nature in our lives, in our hyper-connected society, and in the way that we're kind of encouraged to be on this consumerist hamster wheel. And actually, by taking time to slow down and to take in what our surroundings are looking like. So if you're in the country, it's very immersive and you can see the changing colours of the landscapes through the fields and the hedgerows and what's growing. But even if you're in a city, you can look at the sky and the colours of the sky change throughout the year. In the winter, it's often quite grey and icy and dark. And in the summer, you get these vibrant blues and a kind of much more golden tinged light. So it's really about recognizing how nature makes us feel and being able to incorporate that into our homes. And the homes that we featured have been done really soulfully without great cost to the planet or to the people in a really creative way. So we're hoping that by sharing these homes with people who read our book, they'll find things in them that are really easy for them to achieve in a way that feels comfortable and not expensive for them to do so.
Now, you say that, you know, we're lucky in the Northern Hemisphere that we actually have four distinct seasons. Now, in Ireland, and I'm sure in the UK, they get a little bit mixed up. So we sometimes get a very autumnal chill in summertime and maybe, you know, an Indian summer when it should be kind of coming into the winter. So it can be kind of very much a state of flux in terms of the weather. Does that influence then, or does that matter when it comes to colour palettes and things like flowers and plants? Or is it about finding the season that appeals to you most and then using that as your start-off point, irrespective of what it's doing outdoors?
Yeah, exactly that. I think that what we noticed when we were creating the colour palettes is that prior to writing the book, I think we both thought that the palettes would be really very different throughout the seasons. But actually, when you look at the mood boards that we've created for each season, it's often more about the depth of colour or the textures that you're using. So actually, in the summer, you'll have a really soft pink, a little bit washed out. And in the winter, there's a really deep, luxurious, very cosseting, comforting pink. So it's not that we're saying you have to change everything in your house with each season. It's just about working with the light. And exactly what you said, Sinead. You know, I said blue skies in the summer, but actually it's been raining here most of the week and it's dark and grey and felt like winter. So actually, you know, it's about really layering up your home. So on a day like today, it might be that you're grabbing an extra blanket and your walk is in a raincoat and you're bringing in some really nice forage things from the hedgerows, whether it's cow parsley or even something like smoke bush at this time of year, which is quite a deep autumnal colour, is still around in the summer. So it doesn't matter really what the weather's doing. It's about what the landscape's doing and what's accessible to you. And it can be as much about the patterns and imitating the shapes and colours and textures of nature than the actual thing. So it's really about having the benefit of that in your house, whatever the weather's doing.
Now, one of the things I said at the top was that the photography in it is beautiful. It's very enviable and Instagrammable. And Becca, you were responsible for it. So is it achievable in ordinary homes? I noticed that there was a lot of layering and use of light and flowers and plants and all of that to create. It was nearly more a mood than a colour palette.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's achievable to anybody in their home. And you're right there. It's about creating the mood and really tapping into the feeling, like recognizing what makes you feel good. So you might feel better with like minimalism and very muted colors and not too much color and kind of softer materials. Or you might be more of a maximalist and you might like to have lots of colours and textures and materials around you. And I think that, it's just tapping into what makes you feel good.
Now, let's look at the different seasons. So obviously there are four and we're in summer, allegedly, we've been told. So so give us an idea of the kind of colours and palettes that people go with. And I did notice in the book that you take an awful lot of your cues from what you call biophilic design, and this is bringing the outdoors indoors, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. This sort of basic form biophilic design is a way of harnessing the power of nature within the built environment for our physical and mental well-being. So if you're lucky enough to have direct contact with nature, that might be having an oak bench in your house, it might be having a bunch of flowers, or it might be placing a window in a place that feels really connected to nature by taking advantage of a beautiful view. But if you're not able to have a direct connection to nature, it could be having a picture of a seascape or a landscape or a woodland, or it could be having a wallpaper with a wave pattern. All these things that we see and touch and feel and smell in the natural world can be brought into the built environment. And we've just chosen to align it with the seasons because that felt a more natural and sort of sustainable, slow way of living for us. But any season is applicable regardless of what the actual season outside is.
So in terms of summer, the season we're in now, if that kind of is your mood and that's your vibe and that kind of what makes you feel good, are we talking then about fresh, bright textures, things like linens and cottons and hemps and bright colours then? Or what? Where would you go with that?
In summer, actually, the colours become slightly more muted. You'll find that in spring, it's almost as if the like the colours are acidic, the bright yellows and the bright pinks. And then as we come into summer, everything kind of slows down. The grasses kind of, the colour fades, becomes more muted. You'll find that colours are slightly softer. And yeah, you're correct. Like for fabrics, you want the soft linens and the cottons, things that if the sun does come out and it is warmer, those materials that are cooling.
And then I suppose as we get into the colder parts of the year, autumn and winter, we immediately think of things like blankets, layering, candles, all that kind of thing. So what is the deal then with the summery or spring fabrics and colours that you've brought in? Is it about changing them around completely, or is your ethos just to switch up a few things and bring in extra textures?
Yeah, exactly. We absolutely don't want to advocate that you have to each season completely change your home and go to expense to do that. It's much more about having a sort of a supply at home of things that you've built up over a really long time that tell stories for you. So it might be an old Welsh blanket that you put on the bed in winter just to give you a bit more warmth. Or it might be sheepskins that in the summer, maybe you put outside on the chairs in the garden for around a little burner at night, and in the winter they're next to the fire or on the sofa for just that extra level of tactility that can make us feel really cosseted in the winter. So yeah, it's definitely more about having things that are adaptable through the seasons rather than feeling like your house has to dramatically change every season.
Now, I did see that sustainability, and it is the watchword, we talk about it a lot here on the Home Show, but it is a part of this book as well, because you're not advocating run out to the nearest shop and buy all this stuff up. This is not instant IKEA stuff by any means. It's about taking things like personal items you already have. You include heirlooms, but I also loved the idea of taking your hobbies and creating a space in your home to display them. Because, very often if we have a particular hobby, we kind of put away the stuff when we're not using it. But you don't advocate that.
No, I think it can be something to add to it. I think if you're putting it away in a cupboard, then it kind of makes it your hobby less accessible to you. And if it's something that makes you feel good, then you should have it out for display to make it more accessible to you and easier to do that hobby. And then often hobbies, you're creating beautiful things out of them. So like, yeah, definitely keep them on display, like show them off to the people that are coming to your home and to yourself.
So if you play the guitar or you handcraft things or you're a knitter, you're saying use the items you have, display them out because it's part of your personality.
Absolutely. I think as for us, a home is a place that really sparks conversations and tells stories about the person who lives there. It's not a show home. It's not a home that doesn't have personality. So if somebody comes around, there's so many things of interest for them to ask you about and for you to share the stories and the memories. And that, again, makes you feel connected. So in my house, I have above the dining room table, a copper bar. And from that is hanging lots of forage foliage that I collected when we were on holiday in the Frisian Islands, off the north coast of Holland. And to me, every time I look up when we're eating, there's memories of cycling along the coast and of picking the sea kale. And that's really heartwarming for me and makes me feel good, even if it's pouring as rain outside. I can kind of imagine that summer.
All right. OK, well, listen, it's a beautiful book, as I say. And if people want to look for it there, it's called A Home for All Seasons by Kay Presney and Becca Cherry. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us on The Home Show and the best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having us, Sinead.
Yeah, thank you, Sinead. It's been lovely chatting with you.
And you too. Now, children's bedrooms have become a huge market in interior design. You can spend an absolute fortune on trying to get the right look, even if your baby doesn't always appreciate it. Well, here to give us the lowdown is Natasha Rocca Devine. Natasha, you're very welcome back to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, of course, this is right up your alley. You have a little one yourself.
Yeah, Freya was three this week, so absolutely. And we're designing
a home,
Freya. So I'm actually, okay. Thank you. I'm actually in my element. I don't know if she is enjoying it or anyone else as much as I am. am. It's a dream to design a girl's room. And I'm banned from pink from my partner, David. But, you know, I'm sneaking it in.
Okay.
Definitely. Yeah, but look, it's really exciting. And we're living in a time with so much access to wallpapers and so many different fun things for children's rooms. So
is that, do you find when you're designing for other people or giving them ideas that that blue pink thing still exists?
I don't think so anymore. I think nowadays, you know, everything's, particularly for children who are a bit older and going into teenage years, I think, you know, everyone is just a bit more neutral on things. But I do think every child has a passion. So I think like they have to, I always say, teen their dream. So whatever that is, whether it's Marvel movies, whether it's Barbie, whether it's gardening, anything, every child or every teenager has a passion. So it's just to bring that into their bedroom.
You're almost sounding like they should have a say in how their bedroom is done. You know, at what age do you think they're going to say, ah, here, get out, I'm painting the walls black, not speaking about anybody in particular in my family who might have done that.
Do you know what? I think nowadays, I think children are more advanced insofar as in they're more vocal because they're seeing things,
sure are,
you know, iPads and stuff a lot younger. So they're saying, I don't like that. Like Freya saying what she likes, and obviously she doesn't understand the context and things like that, but I definitely think up until maybe 7 or 8 you can kind of get away with whatever, and then from then they're going to be, you know, making a point of you know what they like. But ultimately with property, the way things are now with housing prices and rental prices, you know, you have to maximise the space. So I always think like for their children's room now, you have to think of it as like a playroom, a place for their friends to come and stay, and like their, for their school work, like they have to kind of have a lot of purpose in that room.
Indeed.
So you don't want it too hectic either.
And a lot of cases, kids' rooms would be that little bit smaller than their parents, so you've a limited space. So team their dream. So what kind of things are we talking about there? You mentioned Marvels, but I presume you can talk about colours or Barbie dolls or whatever it is.
Exactly. So I would say like we're blessed with things like Pinterest. You know, you can go on there and have just so much fun. And obviously, depending on your child's age, you can get them involved in that process. And you can, you know, put together boards of different ideas. Or if you know they love like Peppa Pig, I'm not saying you need Peppa Pig everywhere, but whatever their kind of their colour palettes that they're drawn to. And I always think, you know, what they like in terms of what they wear. So Freya is obsessed with pink at the moment. Obviously, she's really young, but let's say that your child has a certain colour palette and what they like to wear, then bring that into their room. You know, because if they go to that, or if they're colouring what they go to or what their favourite shows are. So it's very much about that. And it doesn't have to be one colour. It could be patterns. And some children like very neutral things. So it's just really, I suppose, bearing that in mind, but also bearing in mind your house. You know, you're not going to have, if the house is quite classic contemporary, you might not have a Peppa Pig bedroom.
Yeah, so and just, sometimes, like, I know that they can have an obsession for a couple of years. In then, my kids' cases, it was Barney the Dinosaur, right? I can't stand it. If I hear that music now, I'm ready to kill somebody because I listened to it for years.
Melon, I know.
I understand. And it sounds to me that the marketeers of these cartoons and shows don't understand the, maybe they do, maybe that's the exact point of like how obsessed small children get with it.
So obsessed.
And the merch and the toys and everything that goes with it. And then they can wake up one day and go, I don't like that anymore.
So I think, for example, say if your child likes Barney or Marvel or whatever, bring the colours in to the overall room subtly, like whether it's wallpaper or, you know, the colour. I'm not saying the actual Barney on the wallpaper. And bring, like, create a colour palette. So look at the mood boards, then go into colour palettes. And like I'm saying, like wallpaper paint, like have a specific, whether it's creams or pinks or greens or whatever that is. And then you can buy the Barney duvet. You can bring the fun pieces in and then use it for a couple of years and then donate it, or, you know, sell it on, or, you know, give it to a cousin. So I would say for anything very brand specific, keep it to the accessory, Sinead.
Yeah.
Don't put it into like the wallpaper. Like,
because they're going to end up as hand-me-downs or in the charity shop before you know it.
100%. And also things like, so I love like you could have storks or hot air balloons. I mean, I'm working with Cole and Son wallpaper in there, and there's Graham and Brown. There's, I mean, so many different brands. Next have gorgeous wallpaper. But I, you know, I just love wallpaper because you can have things like, you know, if your child is very feminine, and whether it's a boy or girl, you can have feminine wallpaper. It doesn't have to be, it could be a stork, it could be a hot air balloon, it could be pink, it could be Barbie, whatever that is. But I wouldn't say to go brand specific. That would be my no-go area, Sinead. Do not put a brand on the wall.
No time now for the Liverpool FC wallpaper and themed bed and, you know, all that kind of thing.
If it makes them happy, no problem. But I suppose, it's very much like bring the colour palettes in, but then have the fun with stick on the wallpaper, the poster of the wallpaper, Liverpool.
Okay. Now, your next tip is to space it out. And as you were saying earlier, to have as much space as you can get, because kids like to play in the rooms, but they also have to do other things there as well.
And they're going to grow up and they're going to have homework and they're going to have their friends over now. And like, I just think the way we live, the like with property prices, etc., like people have smaller homes, people are living, you know, and they're happy to, and each room is multi-purpose. So it's, and particularly if the parents work from home, the children have to go into the bedroom when they're on a call, or you know, things like that. So it's very important to maximise that space.
Now, we have seen lots of furniture, for instance, you know, these cots that turn into day beds with one rail and then they turn into a big bed,
Freya,
and all this
that
kind
actually.
Of thing.
Yeah, so she has a cot.
Okay.
You just unscrew the cot and then it's a day bed, and it's brilliant.
And so they can be expensive, but you're getting them
it's
then till they're about 10 or 11 years old.
And it's gorgeous, Sinead. Like, she's had it since she's three, so that'll be her bed now for the next couple of years.
Yeah,
so it's
brilliant.
And then, I think like things like, I suppose it's like, it depends on the shape of your room, obviously, but like bunk beds, but you can have ones with like storage underneath the desk. You can have a double on the bottom and a single on top. You can have ladders. Like, there's so many fantastic options, but that is a fantastic way to maximize space. You could even have space to have a side locker or different things like that. So it's very much like kind of working out the room and working out who's going to use it. So there's no point in having three beds if no one's going to use it. But just, I think bunk beds are just brilliant.
If they like sleepovers or having, you know, maybe one of their siblings in during the night or whatever.
Absolutely.
But actually, even the single bunk bed, you know, the one that's up high and underneath, then
you can have
that space isn't wasted.
100%. So that's what I'm saying. If you don't need the second bed, you don't put it in. But you're maximising the room. You can put a desk under it, or just have space for play areas, or just have storage boxes. It's just really clever. And I think, like, I always grew up with bunk beds. All my cousins, we all had bunk beds. Like, everyone had them. You always had two and sometimes four in a room, and particularly in holiday homes and things. Like, I designed Borough Holiday Park and each one had bunk beds, whether it was two or two and three. So like a double and a single, and they're just fantastic and they're fun because the kids can all sit in the bed and have, like, just play games or have their iPads or colour or, you know, whatever that is. Chill out.
Well, that means then instinctively that you need to be thinking about storage when it comes to kids' rooms, because they come with a lot of stuff.
So much stuff. Absolutely.
And if you want the stuff to end up in their room and not in the kitchen or in your living room, then you have to have good storage solutions. Talk to me about that.
So as I said, I think things like, as you said, the bunk bed, and I said, the bunk bed is fantastic because you can put under storage underneath that, also under the bed. And you can have beds now that, if you don't want to do the bunk bed style, you can have beds that lift up and have storage underneath. But I think like places like Usk and IKEA are fantastic. You know, have you seen those gorgeous, like the square, they have eight cubes and you can put baskets in and out, and they look stylish. They look fabulous. So they can go into any room. You know, you can put them in and you can have, like, they can be changed at different ages. You can match them, like, when they're kind of a bit older, they can have more fancy kind of baskets that go in it.
And it can go from Lego to school books.
Totally. And you can mark it out and label it and make it really organised. So things like that are fantastic. And obviously, like, in storage, like in a wardrobe, you can have little cubes that you can take out as they get older. But their clothes are tiny. You know, children's clothes are tiny and all the toys are tiny. So I definitely say have an area for clothes and have an area for toys and just keep it separate. But like, ultimately, we are blessed now with all of those different shops in Ireland. You know, just you can order so many different options to suit each room.
Now, one of the things that was a big thing for a while, and I don't know if it still is because all my kids are grown up now, was the kind of having the tent or the teepee, you know,
or a little
place that you can kind of go in and hide and play, because the den is a real part of a childhood.
100%. It's like a treehouse.
Yeah.
But we're in Ireland, so treehouse, unless you have a big garden, the weather is not always great. You'd be stuck out there all day. But yeah, they're gorgeous. I think they're fabulous. And look, I mean, each to their own. Everyone has a different kind of, I suppose, feeling about, you know, things like that, because they are only for a couple of years, but they're fabulous. And like, I remember that. And you mean, you can do a makeshift one with a duvet and like fairy lights and stuff like that, but they are lovely. And I think they're gorgeous when your child's young. And I think it's just, for me as a designer, I just think it's really important to activate their imagination.
Yeah.
So in their room, have space for them to play. Like, you can't complain, within reason, obviously it depends on the size of the home, but even if it's on the bed or moving a bed in a different way or having bunk beds versus two, letting them have space to play. Because I think that's like, if you can't really complain if you don't offer that up, like if they're on an iPad all day. So just having places for colours and just like Lego or simple toys or whatever it is you like. And you can get those foam, you know, the foam for the floor, the kind of jigsaw puzzles that you put down.
They're
great. Easy to wipe as well.
And some of those have like pre-printed things on them, like a streetscape they can use for little cars or, 100%. You know, things like, and actually it kind of doubles up then because it's made of foam, it unlocks and you can chuck
it
away.
And you can wipe it and keep it clean, so it saves stains as well.
Okay. Now, when it comes to the kind of keeping stuff hardy, because it is difficult, kids will ruin anything
Absolutely.
You give them. I found a wallpaper. I came across it. And I don't know if it was you who said it to me. It's a wallpaper that you can actually draw on.
Yeah, it's like charcoal. You know, yeah. You get a chalkboard and you can draw on it. Yeah. And you can buy paint now as well. You can buy paint that you can do that. And I don't know how, I've never actually tried it myself. So I don't know how durable it is.
Yeah,
it's
and there fantastic. Was another one as well, which had the outline of like it was like a cartoon. It was a black and white outline of things, of plants and animals.
And you draw it. Yeah. I mean, and also you can get stick-on ones now. You know, okay. You can get things that stick on because some people don't like their home destroyed. So it's like just for the interim, you can have
that. Destroy your own room. Don't exactly. Think the markers downstairs.
Exactly. Yeah. Freya's done that a couple of times recently, permanent markers. But
lovely, lovely. Well, who left the permanent markers now near her for it to do?
I know. She's very good at rooting. But yeah, look, stencils are fabulous. Like things like that, you can stick stencils onto like a white chalkboard or a black chalkboard and they can just make the room so animated. So definitely love things like that. And that's back to the creativity. Children are like have to like use their imaginations. Yeah. We're living in a world where things are very busy and there's a lot of technology, which is fantastic, but they need to do simple things.
Yeah.
Like draw on an allocated wall. And just to be clear, an allocated wall, not any wall, an allocated wall. So whether it's a small chalkboard, depending on your space, like, you know, it's very much, I think it's such a fantastic thing. Or just even buying like a little whiteboard for them to draw on. It's just really fun for them.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, good luck to Freya. Colour all the walls, sweetheart. Your mum loves the practice. That's
fine.
Great
next time I can.
Okay. Well, listen, great ideas there, Natasha. Now, you are always fantastic now at following through after the show.
Yeah. And especially the book beds and things. I'm obsessed with that because I just think it's brilliant for any home.
Yeah. And it'll give great ideas to you if you want to do that. So Natasha's at the Interiors Nerd. Nerd is NRD, her initials. But and you'll find her on Instagram at Natasha Rockadivine. And there's great ideas there. Natasha, thanks a million.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us. And that is all we have time for on this latest episode of the Home Show podcast. I do hope you enjoyed it and all of the guests we had on. I found it kind of a restful type of show because we were talking a lot about the outdoors and about mindful things. So I quite enjoyed that. But if there's any topic you'd like us to cover, we love to hear from our listeners. So please get in touch with us and our email is thehomeshow@newstalk.com or you can DM me on Twitter or on Instagram at SineadRyan100. You'll find me there. Thanks to the producer, Aidan McKelvey. This week, research was Rory Galvin and Stephen McClune was on sound. We will do it all again next time. Please look out for the latest episodes by liking and subscribing to The Home Show with me, Sinead Ryan. And thank you for your company.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
Saturday morning at 8. On News Talk.